I think we can start. So for those who don't know me, my name is Marco, and I'm working at the University of Glasgow as a postdoc in Dan Hayden's group. And the motivation of my talk is that chatting with people in the last week here, I've realized that a lot of people are interested or have used next generation sequencing technologies, and they are kind of aware of the revolution that is changing the sequencing world in the last few years. But nobody has given like an overview of the possible techniques and what are the differences and the good and bad points of all these techniques. So I decided to come in and try to give you an overview about all these technologies. And then if I have time, talk a bit about how we have used them and how we have tried to apply next-generation sequencing to determine variability in viral population.
So,
outline is something that I think is quite provisional for this kind of audience, because I hope I can get the end. But if I don't, it's not a big deal, as long as you've got something. So the idea is starting with talking a bit about sequencing technologies, give an overview about the old ways of obtaining sequences, so-called Sanger sequencing. Have a look at the next generation platforms that are around. These are mostly these three, and I know quite a lot about this one because we have worked a lot with them, with their data. I know a bit about this, and I know almost nothing about this, but I'll try to give you a little bit of an overview of what I know. And then also mention what's the next step, because people are already talking about third generation sequencing. And then, and here comes the tentative, if it works, I can try to talk about a bit of what I do, which is multi-scale viral evolution of, well, viral should be there, evolution of single-stranded RNA viruses, and in particular talk about within-host evolution, because that's where we have applied this technique to. So every talk about next-generation sequencing has to start with a kind of wow effect. So you have to see how tremendous the increase in output has been, and you can compare it to Moore's law of computer, and that's much quicker. We've witnessing basically a deluge of data that is coming in, that arrived in the last few years, when the first, around 2005, when the first next-generation sequencer have appeared. Before, sequencing was done with Sanger in a kind of slow way. There's been increased a bit with the same technology, but automatized in what is called capillary sequencing. This is where the short reads of sequencing went, and the number of reads, this is a log scale, so this is much more than exponential, is coming up, and this is a projection about data from the third generation techniques. Again, I hope this curve doesn't go like that, because already we have a lot of problems analyzing and making sense of all the data that come around. I actually hope that the data will become less, but we can tell more from them. We shouldn't be worried about removing errors and struggling with short reads. So more high quality data would be better than more data. And so this is another wow slide. So we did, the genome project was done in 10 years, complete in 2000, year 2000, and it was sequenced that covers 10x, which means that each base was on average sequenced 10 times. It took 30 billion in 10 years. Now we can do it in 14 minutes and $5,000. So it's changed a lot. And this tremendous increase in output, but this is only raw output.
Just one question. Is this a fair comparison? I mean, this is not a de novo sequencing, right?
It's not a fair comparison. it's a wow slide. So it's a,
because if I gave you like some animal from Mars or so, which happens to have a DNA-based genome, but we have absolutely no similarities to any organism. See, you could not do it in 14 minutes.
Absolutely. What you can do in 14 minutes is obtaining an amount of base pairs similar to what they obtained in 10 years.
Okay, yeah.
What it goes to assembly and like making sense of this data is a completely different issue. And actually, we're going to talk a lot about it. But the number of the amount of physical data you can produce is same order of magnitude. So people have started talking about even more ambitious projects. like having a thousand of different human genomes sequenced, or bringing down the cost to the sequencing of a human genome, possibly like trying to envision some, you know, therapeutics or some health application, having a sequencing human genome for $1,000. We're actually not that far. Probably this is a bit optimistic, but probably these two projects are now feasible and will probably be completed in the next few years. But again, as I said, what are we actually doing with all this data? This is another cartoon that I've seen taken from another presentation. I mean, we have a huge amount of these sequences, but what do we do with them? The ability to analyze and to handle the data is completely different from the skills that are required now are completely different from what they were required 10 years ago when people had a handful of long reads, and that's why most of the old programs that are used, software programs that are used to handle the old kind of sequences don't work with this new form of data. So these are, okay, some resources. The best, I'm actually using some of these web pages just to give you an idea of how sequencing work. This is a very good article that just reviews, I hope you can see it. It's Nature Review Genetics 2010, it's about a year old. But it's a good overview of how these techniques work and roughly what you can do with them. And of course, there are like tons of specialized articles. Another resource I'll be using a bit is, I don't really see it, but this is the Scottish Bioinformatics Forum, where people have been quite forward-looking and bring together all bioinformaticians and biologists working with next-generation sequencing data every 2 months, and we exchange ideas and we try to make sense of the new technology. So, in order to see how sequencing works, let's start with the old school. Do you know you know what this is?
A monitor.
It's a monitor and the whole thing. This is an old monitor. So that can give you a clue. This is an old sequencing machine, also called Sanger sequencing machine. And the best way to see how this works is actually using one of the websites I've seen that has some nice little movie that tells you a bit how it works. So you heat up your DNA, you separate the two strands, you attach a primer to one side of the strand. There is a polymerase that incorporates nucleotides. Until a certain point, it finds one fluorescent nucleotide that causes the polymerase to fall off. You separate the strand again, and you have a fragment with a certain length, which end with a particular base. You do it again, and since this is a stochastic process, you will end up, at a center point, you will incorporate a different fluorescent nucleotide that will create another fragment, has a different length, but has the same another fluorescence nucleotide attached at the end. So what you do, you basically end up with a collection of fragments whose lengths and colors are fixed. You process them somehow. You run them through a capillary where they basically get separated by size. Longer sequences go, they are shorter, and then you excite with the laser, and you see the different colors of these sequences, and you decode the DNA template you started with. Again, this has worked very well, but it's a kind of laborious technique that requires a lot of manual work, and it's been automatized in these like 96 capillary wells, but still has a limited automatization capability. So in the end, you end up, I think this is like the way to stop. You have different fragments, each one with a different fluorescent bead attached, expression the label attached, they are different lengths, and with this, you separate these fragments and you decode the sequence. Couple of consideration about it. This is a fast technique. Next generation sequencing are slow. They take probably an Illumina run takes now about an hour for each base pair that is attached to all the reads. So for 100 base pair read, you need 100 hours plus preparation time. the power is that you do it many, many times at the same time. Compared to new technologies, it's expensive, but it gives you very long reads, which means that the sequences you obtain are long. I think they're about in the order of 1,000 base pair, probably. If people have, like, they know more than me, please step in and tell me and correct me or just add bits, I don't know. Clearly, in the high side of next generation technologies, this throughput is low, and the output of it is what is called consensus sequencing. So you kind of rely on the assumption that all the templates that you sequence have the same sequence, and if you have variation in your template, what this technology will pick up is the most frequent base at each position in your genome. And it becomes relevant later when you work on viral population that have high variability or quasi-species, in which this gives you only a partial information about the variability that is present in the population. So this is how it looks like, the data, how it looks, they look like. You have bands, this was done with the gels, you have bands with colors, and then you decode the sequence. Okay, an alternative approach if you want to have a single genome sequencing, it would be like doing cloning, so like taking like a single molecule and work on it in some way, I don't know, but you end up having the sequencing of a single individual. But this is...
You PCR
it up, okay. So there's an amplification step anyway. So
you might still get errors possibly from the PCR.
Okay, that's interesting. I'll talk about PCR error later. So this would be like another way, which is even less parallelizable and is quite time-consuming.
This is only expensive because it is time-consuming. It's not expensive per se.
Well, the cost per base pair is much higher.
Because of work hours of people working.
I think it's mostly quantity of reagents. I mean, the thing that you do when you have like a Illumina plate, you basically you don't need a lot of reagents because they're all shared between the reads. Whereas here, each capillary has to have, I mean, the amount of reagent per base pair you use is much, much higher than in the other techniques. And of course, there is also the like manpower cost. So this is another machine that looks a little bit more modern, but is actually the oldest one among the next generation sequencer. It's called 454. It's been introduced in 2005. I have a little movie about 454 too. It just gives you the idea. This is a fantastic website, by the way. And just gives you a bit the idea of the revolution of this technique. So you start with your DNA. You break it in pieces. You attach little adapters at the pieces, at the ends of your fragments. These fragments are size selected, so they're roughly the same size. And then what you do with this, you add some little beads that have on their surfaces, are coated with some sequences that hybridize with the bits you have attached to your sequence. You tune the concentration so that there's on average one bead per sequence, and then you do a PCR step at the level of the bead. So the bead is covered with sequences that are all the same, and then it's done in droplets, so like little emulsions that separate all the beads. Then what you do, you separate all the beads in a micro, you put them in micro wells, and each bead is gonna give you a read. And the way you do, you just flow different bases that have a fluorescent probe in it, and the one that attaches sends a signal to the, that can be picked up by a camera, basically. So if an A is touched, the color is done, it's actually worth replaying this bit because it's interesting. So if a base is attached, just it gives a different signal with a different color. In the case of 454, if more bases can attach at the same time, so you actually get a signal not only from the color that tells you the base, but also from the intensity of the fluorescent, which gives you the number of bases that are attached. This has a couple of consequences. First, that reads are not the same length, because sometimes you could have, you know, if you have a homopolymer, that will be sequenced in one step, and it will cause this particular read to be longer than another one. So there is a distribution of sizes of reads. And second thing that causes, like, the biggest problem with 454 is that when you have long homopolymer, and by long I mean over 5 or 6, it's very hard to say, to distinguish the intensity of these peaks. So you can tell very well the difference between height 2 and height, it's actually more smeared than that, it's like a distribution. It's very easy to tell the difference between 1 and 2, but it's not very easy to tell the difference between 5 or 6 or 7. So the main problem this technology has is that it introduces indels. So it calls 5As when there are 6. And so that could be a problem if you're looking for a certain application. So I think I've done this. So the length of the reads is distribution between 100 and 1,000. In fact, now I think the average is about 400, 500, something like that. The throughput is still relatively low, at least as compared with the other platforms. And therefore the higher cost per base pair, and the most easily introducible errors are insertion of deletions because of the problem for the homopolymers that I've told you. I mean, insertion of deletion will happen at homopolymers. Next one, this
just one question. So does it measure the fluorescence separately for each beat, or do you average?
What happens is that this is true also for Illumina. You've got, like, there is a camera that takes pictures, and you have spots, and each spot is a read. Okay, so you have a kind of star plot, and then at time zero, this spot will be red, and then I will call an A, let's say, and then you image it again one nucleotide afterwards, and I have probably a spot of another color, and there will be another base. And then the brightness of this spot will tell you how many of these bases I will have. And this is the same, roughly the same method is used as Illumina. So there is a high sensitivity camera that is able to take these pictures and traduce this picture to bases, basically. This picture actually not even stored anymore because the camera gets rid of them because they're high quality and they're, you know, huge files. So the decision of the producer has that this level of information is not going to be available anymore, but you'll only have the read.
But each spot is a bead.
Each spot is a bead.
And each one has its own sequence. So
No, absolutely. So that they will look like, they call it like star-like plots. So they look like stars in the sky with different, on a black background with different colors.
And is it, again, like in Sanger, you're flowing in fluorescently labeled cases?
Yeah.
One at a time, so.
Yeah, exactly. You flow them one at a time and you see which one is excited. Yeah, for actually, you're perfectly right. For you flow them A, C, T, G, or whatever order it is, and then you do it again, and then you do it again, and then you see which one is lit up.
So to the person who asked about the cost, right? So here you only need the fluorescently labeled nucleotides. In the Sanger, you need about 100 times as many non-fluorescently labeled ones because you always to first build up the sequence, right? So there you have already a factor of 100.
Well, that's probably roughly the cheapest thing in the whole equation. Mm-hmm. Unlabeled DNTDs are astonishingly cheap. Yeah.
So a factor of 100 makes no difference.
There's zero next to the cost of the labeled one.
Yeah. And you need several, it's like a factory in place.
So then where do the cost?
I think, like, you know,
it's because one of these machines, like in extension machines, are in produce data. For Sanger sequencing, you need several machines to run.
I mean, a machine in Sanger will have 96 wells, and that will give you 96 reads of 1,000 each. This thing can give you 500,000 reads of this length we have seen.
That's how many stars are in the sky.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. That would be, to be honest, okay.
I see. So
this would be like, you know, done in sweeps. So you just do it.
Factory, you need a serial machine personnel.
This, if this is your whatever it is, your device, you just image it like bit by bit, and there will be 500,000 spots in the sky, and you do it like sequentially.
And every, like, really one single beat per point.
Yes.
How do they do that? Okay, sorry.
Good question. I don't know. I don't know really. I mean, they kind of tune the concentrations, and sometimes you will have reads that make no sense.
There are small wells that.
Yeah.
So it's really nano, all on nanoscale.
Okay, if I can comment maybe on this, on the Illumina's this technology that I know a bit better. In this case, you don't have beads, you don't have like. Sequences that are attached to a surface that attach randomly, as I'll tell you in a second. It's basically two sequencing attached too close, and these dots are overlapping. They will basically interfere, and you'll discard them because they will make no sense. I mean, this is not an exact thing at all. I mean, the philosophy is that we get so much of it that if something doesn't really work, well, fine. There's still a lot.
Yeah, it seems like it could be some genetic variability in the sequences attached to a single beat.
Right.
Can there be some genetic variability?
There should not, because, one beat should attach one sequence, and the sequence should be amplified so that this beat is covered with a lot of sequences that are absolutely identical.
Except there's errors in the applications.
Right, but...
But anyway, attachment is also a Poisson process, right? So either you have really poor yield, or you'll sometimes get two attached to the same.
It could be. I haven't worked directly with this data, so I can't
answer. But I would assume that in all of those cases, your data just doesn't make sense. I mean, you get spots that like light up in two colors at the same time or so, and you're just...
Yeah. You do it. I mean, there are what you do usually. I mean, for this technology, I know a bit better. It's you do quality control at the end. So I mean, you just have some software that filters out the bad reads. Because this is actually the machine in Glasgow. This is an Illumina machine, as you probably have suspected. This is an old one. It's called Genome Analyzer 2X, whatever. Now they have bigger machine that do more yield, or smaller machine that do smaller yield, and they are more affordable. But again,
typically, how many reads do you throw away by quality control? Like,
I think you are in the order of 2%, up to 10%.
More than that, actually.
Four. Yeah, I'm talking about Illumina.
Oh yeah, sorry.
Okay, just thanks for stepping in. It's all a bit of a tinker. I mean, you have to prepare, you have to have like a good technician that knows how to use those, the concentrations of, in this case, the beads. And I mean, if you're not precise there, then you will have more reads to throw away. Okay, again, I'll just give you a little movie on that. That's the last one, I promise. Whoop. It's very similar to 454, so you already know this bit, fragmentation and adapter ligation. This time you just don't add beads, but you flow all these segments in a flow cell that is covered by a loan of adapters. So randomly some of them will attach. So they will flow. Some of them will attach, not too many, because you need to amplify. There's a step called bridge PCR, where basically this sequence is curved and then amplified, hybridized to another primer and then amplified. This is basically to increase like the fluorescence signal, so that the spot is brighter and the camera can pick it up. That's the same of the PCR on the beads. So you end up with clusters, and you do something very similar to 454, except that in this case, you add one nucleotide at a time. So you don't add a homopolymer together, but you just add one base at a time. And the following steps are basically the same. You get a star plot, in which this time you don't care about the intensity of the plots, but only the colors. And basically you carry on. Biggest differences with 454 is that, well, it's a trade-off. The rates are shorter because basically the technique loses of resolution after, let's say, about 100 cycles. Used to be 50, now most of labs get to 100. Illumina claims they can go up to 150. Not much room for development before beyond that. I mean, longer reads, you need another technology. This just won't work. One thing you can do, though, is if you...
Is it just the ability to form these loops on the...
I think it's just the signal... I think it has something to do with the fluorescence signal, just degrades. So these spots, like... I think you have probability that, like, older base pairs that were in the previous cycle stick around and perturb your spots, but I'm not sure about it. And it just, as you see in a sec, basically the quality of your reads decreases. And at a certain point, well, you could go on, but it would be so bad that it's not worth, and that's where you stop. The other thing you can do, though, if you remember, that on the flow cell, you had like these things, and they are hybridized here, and they have little primer here. And what you do, you sequence this bit up to 100 nucleotides, as we said. But you can also sequence this bit up to 100 nucleotides. So you will have like a piece of DNA which is about 400 nucleotides plus two adapters. And you could get, if you want, a read here from the first 100 and a read here from the last 100. This is called paired-end reading. Paired-end reads. What's the advantage of this? Because you get two reads per cluster instead of one, and you get the separation, because you know the size of this fragment. This could be crucial if you want, as Klaus pointed out before, like you want to align your reads to a complicated genomes, because you can have many, many problems in aligning short reads when you have, you know, a higher organs genome.
Also, you get linkage information, right?
Yes, I'd comment on that too. Okay, this is the technique that has the highest throughput so far. If you remember, I told you you had like 500,000 reads for 454. Here we are about, with this machine, we are about in the 30 million range. Shorter, but a lot more, and the new machines do much more than that. So, huge amount of things. That brings you a low cost for base pairs. Indels are not really probable for this chemistry that basically adds one nucleotide at a time, but you could have point mutations, of course. But I'll comment on that too. Last technology, ABI solid. I know very little about it. So what I know is that, again, it does short reads, about 50 base pairs. It works in a kind of weird thing that is called color space that gives me the headache every time I try to understand it. But basically, someone has used this technology here. Probably, okay, so then you have to stick with what I understand of it. So you basically have a signal for each pair of nucleotide. So you have four colors available. And if you have AA, it would be blue. If you have AC, it would be green. If you have AG, it would be orange or whatever it is. So you get a signal for your sequence. Then you do a one base pair shift, and you resequence. And then, so that would be like a bit this idea. So this blue should be AA. This one should be AC and overlapping with the blue. And you can kind of make sense of this sequence of colors. Problem is that most of the algorithms that are proposed to analyze this data are in color space. So they use this level and not this. And it's hard. And then there's one thing I call the conspiracy. Because every time I go around and to these bioinformatics forums, I hear bad things about this technology. I don't know what it is. What I know is like some genome institutes have stopped buying these things, these machines, and they are mostly relying on others. Some developers of some big assembly softwares like commented that for him, this kind of data don't make much sense, so he doesn't trust them, and he doesn't want to develop a software that analyzes them. I don't know, I'm just reporting it. What is the fact I see about it is that they are not much used. Despite, if you go to a talk by one of these guys, they will tell you that they can beat the hell out of all the others. But again, I've never seen real data of it. So this brings me to the Last thing, again, third generation technologies are already on the brink of being on the market. The big difference is that they will use single molecule sequencing. So they won't have an amplification step that will give either a bit covered with the sequences or a cluster like this. Problem is that to cut long story short, they don't work yet. I mean, I'm not sure really sure how many of them have been issued on the market. I think Helicos had. I mean, probably, Villa, do you know about it? Just no. They have different ideas to do single molecule sequencing. In this case, they basically is a kind of Illumina, but they have a camera that is sensitive enough to get a signal from a single molecule. In this case, you have little nano holes where the sequencing goes on. This is actually a very cool idea. It's like pulling a molecule through a nanopore and measure the difference, the currents induced in the pore by the different bases. But as I said, I think the only technology I know that they have some data out is this, and again, they have huge error rates, which make the whole thing not competitive yet. There's a big excitement in the field for the future development, but what I can say now, they're not there yet. So, it could change again, but we don't really know how. Okay, that's that's from the review paper I told you before. You can see basically that's a year old. You can see like the cost of this machine ranges about, $500,000. The read lengths are 400 for 454, and the others are smaller. You can use biological application. I'll comment to them in a bit. And we don't know much about this third generation machine even a year later.
Something, what's the advantage of this third generation? I'm not sure I understand.
It's not, okay. In this case, you have to go through, it's what basically Alan said before. If you have to amplify your sample, you can introduce errors. So you would rather have, ideally measure the sequence, obtain the genome of a single molecule. At the moment, this is not possible because the signal is too weak and the camera or whatever it is cannot pick it up. If it can, it would remove an error-inducing step, which everybody would like to get rid of. And then you would have much less problem about giving enough material to be sequenced. So that's another big thing, we sequence viral, foot and mouth viruses, and we have to amplify it. So it's amplified before the sequencing, and it's amplifying during sequencing. So that can create problems.
When you say single molecule, the whole length of the
DNA? Ideally, yes. I don't know what to. It's actually say about the read length. Here.
No, but the main point right now is they sequence directly one molecule.
Yeah.
They don't amplify.
No, I know, but I'm saying they sequence pieces, small pieces of DNA.
Well,
that depends on the method.
The only thing I know here is that here you have read length very low. But for this one of this third generation sequencing, I think that the objective would be like to have long reads again. But
because my question is, if it's just a piece of the DNA, then you have to sequence other parts of it, so you have to make a copy.
So I don't know.
So it only makes sense single copy. And then that one should be also, this problem of repeats and everything.
I'll be happy to know more about this in a few years. Well, just a couple of slides just to raise discussion, about the applications that these technologies are good for. One thing would be like resequencing. So you have a genome that you already have a template, and you want to sequence it again to check it up and to see if you have variances, or you're sequencing the genome of a different member of a species, but like two different human genomes. So the main problem here is alignment. So you know more or less where these things go. Alignment, it cannot be trivial if you have very large genomes on billions of base pairs. and particularly hopeless if you have small reads or repeated part in the genome. So in this case, using paired adrenes is absolutely mandatory if you use Illumina. And still, I mean, if you have a repeated part in your genome that is longer than this chunk, which is not very long, you won't be able to know where it aligns. So if you want to detect, like, I don't know, if you are looking at RNA sequencing and you want to see the abundance of those two transcripts, you wouldn't know where this transcript is. Another thing you can do is de novo sequencing. So you sequence something you don't know the genome, and you try to make sense of this collection of reads, basically by trying to concatenating them together. Very difficult. There are several, I don't have much of experience in this. I know there are several packages that rely on different strategies. They are all incredibly computationally demanding. So we're talking about at least 48, 64 gigabytes of RAM, because to store all these different possibilities. At the moment, I think probably, correct me if I'm wrong, it's possible for genomes of a smaller size, like probably in a few millions of base pairs. It's a big problem, and it's not easy to deal with, too. Another thing you could do is the metagenomic approach, in which you sequence something, a sample that could be from, I don't know, human gut or ocean, as Forrest said last week, and you don't know what it is, what you're sequencing. You know which species are there. So you try to make sense of these reads, and you try to cluster them together and say, okay, these belong to this organism, these belong to this organism, and you try to make sense of these different sequences. Another thing you can do, again, is sequencing RNA, so not the genome of an organism, but it's a transcript. There are very good methods to get rid of ribosomal RNA and see only the mRNA of a cell. What I know one possible application I've seen doing is like try to detect new splicing junction and like comparing the genome with the reads and see if you find new alternative spliced proteins, alternative splicing messenger RNAs. Again, not easy because the reads are small. And another thing which I know very little about is ChIP-seq that is like chromatin immunoprecipitation followed by sequencing. And this aim to detect protein binding sites on the DNA. Okay, just want to raise a couple of points that might not be trivial when you use this kind of technologies. So one is that, okay, you have...
Can I comment on the previous slide?
Sure.
I just wanted to point out, so you kind of, maybe with the exception of the last two, you focus on the immediately obvious things, but I think what really is going to happen, it's already happening, and will be happening much more. We have to think of, okay, sequencing essentially doesn't cost us anything, right? That's where we're heading. So there will be a huge number of initially very non-obvious applications of what we can do with sequencing. Like ribosomal profiling, where you take mRNA, you chew away the pieces that are not covered by the ribosome, and then you sequence the pieces that are covered by the ribosome, and then you get a map of where are the ribosomes as the cell translates, right? And you already pointed out, like, splicing, but really more importantly, expression levels and so on,
yeah,
right? So sequencing will become essentially our new microscope into what is going on in the cell.
I completely agree. I think imagination is the limiting factor here, and software. I mean, these are the things you can find some software for. If you want, it's perfectly fine. So it's great actually to think about new applications, but most of the time you have to develop your own software, and that's really the bottleneck. So you have to bring together a bioinformatician or someone that knows how to deal with these things. Because again, one of the problems is that, okay, when you have gigabytes of data, I mean, you start raising questions about what you store. Do you store the whole reads? Do you store the analysis? Do you store the filtered reads? So do you store the reads you exclude from your analysis? Can largely, I mean, how do you make them available to public? How do you annotate them? There are open questions that people are trying to think about now. The other thing is exactly what Klaus said, like the expertise. I mean, who can handle these reads? It's not there's no like friendly software for analyzing them, and there probably won't be because there's so much data. You have really to use all the computing power to do the calculation, and you don't have time to have a fancy package around it. Another thing is that how much is a support job looking at these reads? How more is a research question? I mean, how much we should think of the person who handled this read as technicians, or is that where is the boundary with a new science or a new way of analyzing data? I think I've already told you that different platforms are for different tasks, and as we said before, you need to develop pipelines that bring you from the raw data to what you want. There are pipelines for the few applications I told you before, but it's really like mostly unexplored. That ends my part on sequencing. So if you have any other question, I am happy to take them. Otherwise, I will go on some application of this.
Thing. On the Illumina, do you still have problems with indels? If you have repeated bases, they all sort of light up?
No, because the bases are sequenced one by one. So if you have 10A, we need 10 cycles to get the 10As. Whereas in 454, you will get in one cycle, and that's where the error comes.
How do they keep multiple ones from detection?
They're base pairs. The fluorescent base pairs have a terminator that basically stops the attachment of the next base. So there is one step in which you, after you've done your imaging, you remove the terminator and you're like, no. So that's...
So one cycle is time... Like,
it's one hour per base.
1 hour per base, but you have like 13 million, so...
1 hour for base for each read.
Yeah.
So there is, so again, a good rule of thumb is like 100 base pairs, 100 hours, plus a bit of preparation time. In Glasgow, it's 79 base pairs, and it basically we it's a week altogether. So you give them the stuff on you, they start the process on Friday and get the data the Friday after.
Just maybe stupid, but so the only limitation of Sanger sequencing is that I cannot parallelize it. But if someone thinks of a microfluidic sort of device that does that, wouldn't it be competitive with the other techniques?
I don't think so, because there's like a huge gap to be bridged. And it's not single molecule. So you would have anyway a kind of average of your population for each base pair. And I mean, we would like, so the big nice thing about Sanger is that you have long reads. But I'm not sure if it's parallelizable more than it's been done so far.
What do you mean with pipeline?
Pipeline would be like a series of algorithms. So that's really like bioinformatical jargon. And it's a series of algorithms that will bring you from the reads to your final results through, you know, an alignment step, a quality filter on quality step, error calling step, and
so you can. Software again.
It's a software that is modular, so it just does one thing after the other.
Yeah. So when you fragment the DNA, does it always fragment the same places, or is there random so that you can overlap?
Good question. The fragmentation is done by sonication, which means it's basically like a sound wave that just breaks where it breaks. You can argue that it would break in weaker point of the sequence, but I don't know. I don't have data on that. Moreover, what you do is a size selection. So after you've fragmented your DNA and these fragments have a distribution of sizes, you only keep those that have the right size to do this thing. So there's a kind of random step in between anyway.
Is there enough overlap that you could actually sequence sort of a longer, you know, piece together? fragments or anything?
In principle, yes. I don't know if it interferes with the amplification step there. I think probably the sequence have to be a certain length to do like the nice bridging PCR. You see what I mean? So there's a step of amplification of the hybridized sequence here, where the sequence have to go, have to curve and has to do some things. And if you make them too short, such that these two bits are basically touching each other, probably the amplification wouldn't work. That's what I think.
There are all kinds of unresolved questions. A student at UT is looking at what's the best way to prepare the sequences and the fragments. The problem is that you do not get uniform coverage.
Oh, not at all.
If you wanted to say you want to use this as a way to measure expression levels, right? You'd want to have uniform coverage over your mRNA so that then you just count the abundance of reads and that tells you the expression level. And if you just make a plot, let's just say this is your mRNA, right? The whole thing is expressed, so you would want, if you make a histogram, you just expect the uniform coverage, right? It looks something like this. Sometimes you have gaps, like, where it just doesn't read anything. That's a big unresolved issue. Oh, you have to, yeah.
So I thought that's exactly what we see. This is the coverage of a viral genome. And in addition to that, we sequence three different...
That's a log scale, right? So if you were
it's huge. It's huge.
Level, that would be a
this
problem.
Is genome. Yeah. And the other thing that is quite puzzling is that these three sequences, which are three independent samples of the same virus, are awfully correlated. And we don't really know why. But it's...
It but might... flips, right? That's also interesting.
Okay, no, okay. That's a problem of preparation, sample preparation. So it's because the DNA came in two amplicons that were mixed at the same equimolar concentration. So if you look only, like, let's say, look only one half, and you see, like, or for instance, you take these two ones, you see they're tremendously correlated. Very good. Thanks for anticipating that.
For gene expression data, fluctuation RNA structure. So when they break,
absolutely. Yeah.
That's what you see.
And that would make sense.
Is that a fact or is that a hypothesis?
I'm not saying there aren't other things.
Because we try to
I'm not saying there aren't other things, but that is a fact.
How has that been demonstrated?
Well, I don't remember on top of my head. But it has been both.
Well, if I want to comment, I mean, what you saw before, it was actually DNA. So that happens in DNA too.
Yeah.
That was a cDNA from a viral RNA. Good. So I'll try to be very quick and tell you something about how we have used these techniques. So that's to sketch you the grand picture. What I like, what I'm interested is basically how viruses evolve on different scales and how variability is transmitted from one scale to the other. So starting from a cell that is infected by viruses, this is clearly where the virus replicates and where variability is generated. Then in a kind of... stupid thing? Okay. Then the virus can infect like neighboring cells, get into a tissue of the host, if the host is a higher organism, as is in my case. They can then spread to the whole host, and the host can transmit now the infection to another host that is in the close proximity of the host through a transmission bottleneck, and then eventually the infection will spread at the landscape level in a large scale. So all these processes are linked by all these stage scales are linked by processes I'm interested to study, and in particular what I've done so far is like try to make sense of this a bit, and as I'll try to show. And the kind of system where I will be working on will be again, single-stranded RNA viruses, because they are those who evolve faster, in the sense that they generate more variation. They have a very small genome, and they form huge population inside the host. And in particular, we have data. So this kind of foot and mouth is our favorite viruses, because we have access to a lot of data. So it's a picorna viruses. By the way, in 2 years working on it, I never made sense of the name of picorna. It's like means like small RNA virus. Oh, that's already like a big big advancement for me in this workshop. So so from that, I can tell you that like foot and mouth is a virus of cloven hoofed animals. So it infects pigs, sheep, cattle, and also other animals like deer and buffaloes. It's very infectious. It's not lethal for the host most of the time. It manifests itself as blisters on, lo and behold, the foot and the mouth of the animal. And but it's a huge economical problem, because basically nobody wants to buy meat or milk from an animal that has been infected from this virus, although the probability of getting the virus is very, very small for humans. There's been like a huge outbreak in 2001 in the UK. Millions of animals were culled, so people started funding studies on to study these kind of viruses. A similar situation that we have access to is on the plant virus. It's called plumpox virus. Affects fruit trees, spread in southern Europe, in eastern Europe, and probably in other parts of the world. Again, it damages the leaves and the fruits of the host. Is not a problem for humans, but nobody would buy a peach that looks like that. So we have to stay clear of that.
That's a marketing problem, right?
It's an economical threat.
You have to market it as something special. Marbled peaches.
That would be a good shot. So, but what is nice about these two viruses is that they have a very similar genome and a very similar size and genome organization. I'll talk mostly about foot and mouth today. So another thing is that, well, if you look at clones of foot and mouth, you do see variability. Actually, this one shouldn't be here. But you can see that there are like differences in the different clones that you find from the same viral sample. Some differences are shared, believe me, they are behind here. Some differences are unique. And just anticipating what Klaus will talk about later, a lot of people call this a quasi-species. You might or might not disagree. I don't want to enter into that. For me, it's like an heterogeneous population. And so what we have done is we've done the Illumina sequencing of the viral genome, and then we have aligned our sequences from a reference that was on the reference that we already knew. Again, the single reads come from single viral genomes, so we expect to see some variation from the consensus that's been obtained before. So what we do, we align our reads. This is very easy because it's a short genome, so no problem at all. Sometimes we see variation and we start looking vertically, and we see sites where there is no variations, sites where you have some variations. Sign when the variation is repeated in more than one read, and all down to the case where the variation is repeated in most of the reads. So we try to make sense, to measure the diversity of the viral population that was collected in the host using this kind of approach. In the particular samples, we have actually access to a very neat experiment where a host was inoculated with a virus that was a full population, so collected from the field, not clonal, although passaged in cell culture. The way the infection works is that the virus goes in the throat of the mouth, it replicates there as a first time, it's kind of hidden from the immune system, it goes into the blood. From the blood, it reaches the peripheral epithelia, and then it forms lesions, so blisters, on the feet and the mouth of the cow. So what we've done is that someone has infected a cow with this, the cow has developed the disease, and we have access to basically what got in the cow and two lesions of the fit that was basically the population that got out from the cow. So we kind of can kind of make sense of how the host processed this population.
Oh, is that the transmission cycle? So the cow sheds it into the grass and then another cow eats the grass? Is that how it...
No, that's one possible route. The most frequent transmission route is oral, because they have lesions in the throat, so they breathe virus out all the time. The virus is very infectious and some other breathes it. Of course, it's also possible that, you know, a lesion breaks and on straw, on the grass, you pick it up from there, but the most...
Is there common transportation of this?
Oh, yes. Okay, this is actually a nasty bug. I mean, it survives very well outside of the host, so you can attach it to inorganic materials.
Just seems
and
curious.
Just goes away.
It's the mouth and the feet. Like, almost seems like it might have adapted. I mean, that makes it be distributed in the ground where the cows walk. Right?
And I have no idea if, well, what I would think is that these two epithelia are similar, but I really have no idea.
It matters if the temperature.
Sorry?
Would it be cold adapted? And
it's quite temperature sensitive.
Those regions probably have lower temperature than core body temperature.
Could be. I know this is, I don't know about temperature, but this virus is extremely sensitive to pH. So it could have like temperature sensitivity too. I mean, the way it's actually very easy to remove if you wash it basically with a little bit of an acid solution. But it sticks very well to tires, to Wellingtons. So it's actually very easy to bring it around. Okay, I'm gonna skip that. Okay, so just to give you an idea, that's like how the data look like. And I don't know how many of you have seen it, but this is basically a name of a read, which has coordinates on the flow cell and that basically identify it. This is the read. That's again the same name, and these are base qualities. So you can have a one-to-one relation between this, the base that has been called by the machine, and a measure of how sure the machine was that it saw what it saw. This basically quantifies how neat the fluorescent spot was. And you can relate this ASCII code to a probability of error that is quite well correlated. And one thing that you will see is that you see that the symbols change along the read, because basically these are worse qualities than these. And you can actually plot it if you assume this logarithmic relation between the ASCII code and the probability of having a mistake. You see that the quality of the reads is very good towards the beginning of the reads and then deteriorates very rapidly. And at position 30, you already have a 2% error of probability.
You trust their quality scores a lot? I know that the 454 ones have a lot of problems.
I don't know about 454. I had long discussion with people about Illumina quality scores. They've actually been, the way they've measured it is basically doing a lot of sequencing of something they knew about it. It seemed to correlate well. We have actually indications that they overestimate the error. So I'm not sure about it, but we are running like some new samples now where we actually see less error than we expect. So it could actually be that this probability of errors are outdated and they're actually doing better than they say. So what I'm saying is that if you take an average error on the read and you remove the reads with this average error, you can bring this down a lot. So there are a few reads that really corrupt the set. So it's much better to work with less reads but good reads than with all of it. And in this case, these were actually two runs, and here the machine has been upgraded in between. And with the same filter, I managed to save like 60% of the reads and 90 something later on, so it's gotten better. So okay, another thing you can do I haven't touched upon is that you can run multiple samples on the same sequencing. The way you do it is basically you tag each of your original sample with a 6 nucleotide tag, it can be longer if you want, and then you do all the sequencing, and then you look in your reads and you look for the final tag, and you separate your different populations with according to the final thought. So since our genomes were short, we actually did, like, we multiplexed it, as they say. So we had three samples on the same experiment. We are gone up to 12 now.
Is that a channel? Is that what they call a channel? Is that what's called a channel?
No, it's called a lay
channel.
Well,
right? You can multiplex in the same channel.
You
can
multiplex.
I should have asked you in the first part of your talk, what's a channel?
The term I'm more acquainted with is lane.
Yeah.
So you have basically a flow cell when things flow in here and flow out here, and you have reads here. And they are divided in eight lanes, okay? And the lanes is where the sequencing happens. So this is the lane, and you can
put down a line independently in each of the lanes.
Each lane is an independent experiment. You can multiplex on the same lane. Okay. So actually what we do, we buy a lane. We don't buy a whole flow cell. And usually one of them is for control and the other seven are done. We already talked about it. Alignment is trivial, but it fluctuates a lot. And it's in the order for a whole genome of about 8,000 nucleotides. Average coverage is about 10,000. We can do better than that. I'm not sure. So this would be like, I just touch upon this. Don't want to keep you here too long. But sometimes you could have PCR-induced chimeras that would introduce, you can purge for more of most of them because they won't align well. But if the chimeras happens at the edges of your read, they will introduce some variation which is not in the sample, it's completely artifactual. So what you see is that you would expect that the number of errors per read on average will stay flat, whereas they go up at the edges because of these chimeras. The algorithm basically removes all the reads that have more than four mistakes. So which means that if you have a chimera that introduces four mistakes here, you will keep it, but you shouldn't because that part is artifactual. So we just get rid of the two edges to remove another PCR artifact. And then if you align it towards the sequence, the reference sequence of the inoculum, you see that most of the position differs a little bit from the reference, and in some places they differ a lot. And the places where they differ a lot are actually more frequent in the 2 feet that in the inoculum. So, okay, that's another big thing. How do you make sure that what you see is actually real variation and is actually not some kind of artifact? Well, you have to know a bit where the sources of error have been could have come from. One of this is definitely the amplification bit. Amplification, especially this RNA viral sample has been first reverse transcribed to cDNA and then amplified to a PCR via PCR, and then the amplified sample can be sequenced. But already in this passage from host to amplification, there could be artifactual variation introduced by PCR mistake or by the RT mistake. So there's not really way around it. So the way we decide to do is like to do it everything twice and rely on the assumption that having the same PCR error in the same cycle twice independently would be very low. And I'll comment more on that. So we kind of protect it by having two replicas. And so we obtain consensus genomes. One kind of internal check was to reobtain the reference we started from. If we didn't, it could have been an error. And if you look at the feet, this is front left foot, back right foot. We will come back on that again. So you see that there are one, two substitutions per genome when they are fixed during one host passage, which is grossly compatible with what people have measured before with consensus sequencing. Where are these mutations? Are mostly in the 3' untranslated region of the genome and in a particular part of the capsid I will comment about later. So, but if you want to go deeper than that, and not only having the most abundant genomes in the population, but also look at the very fine details of the variations, you have to make sure that you're managing the errors that lead the, in the step from the amplified sample to the reads, and means is basically is the sequencing. Fortunately, we have this miscall properties that are coded in the ASCII code I've told you before. And what we did here is basically, if you look vertically on one position, you just calculate the average variable probability of error that you see over all the reads. We actually is a very peak distribution, so the mean is a good approximation. And we assume that the errors are binomially distributed with this probability and with a number of trials that is the same as the coverage. What this basically tells you is that if you have like 10, covers 10,000 and probability of error 10 to the minus 3, you would expect on average 10 bases to differ from the reference by chance. And you can actually, if you see more than that, you can compute the probability that this would have been arisen by chance, which is a p-value. And then you look at the p-value of each mutation. It's actually much more easily seen here. So if you say like this position, my reference have a G, you have two different runs, I have very good coverage, which varies a lot, but it's still high. And in 66% of the reads, you find an A in both cases. You find, so a bit of the reads have still the original base pair, and there is like little variation that is probably error in the other two channels. What we did here is just compute, so this looks like a consensus mutation that is being fixed, and it actually is because it's high frequency and it's consistent in the two runs. But again, we validated by using these p-values and saying that the p-values in both cases is very low. If you have this situation where you have an A in the reference, an A in most of the reads, but a difference in a minority of the reads, again, it could be a polymorphic, so it could be that there are two genomes in the population that coexist with different variation of this particular site. But again, 10% of 10,000 reads is still 1,000 reads. So it's very unlikely that this has come by error. So again, this is it's very probable that we are seeing something real. In this case, like again, same pattern in the two runs, but very low coverage, very low, relatively low coverage, very low fraction. P-value is going to be high, and we don't validate this site. What is interesting is that if you have an amplification artifact, they will look more or less like that. So you'll have like one run that has a lot of polymorphism, and the other one that has basically no trace of it. So in this case, what you see is that one of the p-values will look fine, but the other wouldn't, and therefore we can filter for this too. If you put everything together, I think that's actually the nicest slide I have. It's one that I like most. So on the x-axis, you have the frequency of mismatches, so what you have seen before. Here, mismatches are mutations that are happening at high frequency of the population. Here is very low frequency, up to zero. And here is their abundance. So what you see here, these cases are the sites with no polymorphism, so where we don't see any variation, and they are few. Actually, these are the sites with lower coverage. So we actually think that if we had more coverage, they would disappear. Which means that a little bit of variation is pretty much everywhere. And the polymerase is a democratic enzyme. So it introduces errors pretty much everywhere on the genome. The large fraction of the variation, however, happened at a very low frequency. We are talking about 0.1%. It's there because it's validated, but it's, you know, a kind of background that we think represents like mutations before selections. So this could be like, you know, viruses that have been copied. We don't know if they've been encapsulated. They're probably not infectious, but they haven't been into another cell and selected out yet. Whereas mutation that happens in a large fraction of the population, let's say above 10%, are few, genes, or like a handful, and those are very unlikely to be deleterious because they've invaded a large part of the population, and they could be, you know, neutral advantages. We don't really know about it, but they probably have a biological meaning.
What are the three traces? I'm sorry. What are the three traces?
Yeah. Okay, sorry. One is the This one is the inoculum.
I see. Okay.
Because that has no mutation in high one, and the other one are the two feet. Sorry, I should have put a legend.
So you said that the pervase permutation is like 10 to the minus 4?
Yeah, like the RNA.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like one per genome, yeah.
So wouldn't like a site that is just, is never goes into a new infection or starts a new infection, is just, you know, comes from the one burst, wouldn't mutations like that be at frequency 10 to the minus 4, not 10 to the minus 3?
Yes, but again, with all these intermediate steps, I'm not sure the frequency, the low frequencies are being conserved. So, and there's, okay. And yeah. One thing, second thing, here we kind of lose resolution.
Yeah.
I mean, we don't see.
Well,
this is where basically you're looking at the error of the machine, so you don't really get 10 to the minus 4.
So to get to this kind of resolution in the population, you need a genome that's not bigger than 10,000 bases. If you don't get the depth, or maybe you need to buy a second channel.
Okay. Yeah, I mean,
all of what goes on at 1% to 1%.
To be honest with you, what matters here is coverage, right? So with this genome and three genome on a channel 1 year ago, we get 10,000 coverage. Now we get probably 25,000 coverage, which means that if you run it for one single genome, will be probably like 70, 80,000 coverage. Then if you have a larger genome, you know, either you put it in pieces or you trade coverage with length.
But you would sort of like to know what goes on at 1% of 1%.
Sorry?
You'd like to know, you're at the noise level
uh-huh.
at 0.0001.
Yes.
Which is about the per genome mutation rate, so you might...
Yeah, I would say actually the noise level is more like about here. It's actually probably in the 2, 3, 10 to the minus 4. So here we are still out of it. And this again, this is 1 year ago data. So actually now you can go, now we think we can get up to here and basically see the peak, if there is a peak here also in this region. Just to make sense, where are the interesting mutation? There were some polymorphisms in the population we started with, which evolved mostly in two regions. This region is again, is 3' untranslated region. You would expect variability there because there's no coding. However, there is a stem loop. What we saw is that all the mutations that were here preserve the stem loop, if you believe the Vienna RNA structure calculations. The other thing which is very interesting is that these mutations happen very close to each other, so we actually have information about linkage. And they were all alternative. So they never happened together. They all happened on different viruses. Same thing here. This is a capsid protein that encodes one of the receptors.
Would they have destroyed the stem loop structure if they had happened together?
Yes, they would. But one by one, no. They will make it a little bit less stable, but still there. And so this, again, is a kind of cool thing because this population was taken in the field and then passaged into cells. And when this kind of virus is passaged into cells, they evolve a new, easier way to get into the cells, binding to, I think, heparan sulfate receptor, which is present in all the cells they have around. However, when they go into the host, if they use this receptor, they will get in cells where they wouldn't replicate. So they have to go back and re-evolve the specific receptors for the cells they really want to get in. And that's basically what we see. So this was the part where the heparan sulfate binding was coded and is lost when you go back into your host. And it is lost in both cases. Which brings me actually to one of my last slides in here, in which you look at the sites that where variability was present at 2% or more in the population. And there was some variability that stays in the population, but some variability that was evolved before the 2 feet were differentiated. And this is exactly, you see the sites are really close to each other, this is heparan sulfate. On top of that, you have variability that is specific to each population. But you have some that is kept, mostly in the tail,
yeah.
Some that arose very early, and some that arose late. So I think I can skip this bit. Ah, okay, that could be nice. Well, I don't have to explain to you what an entropy is. So it's a measure of diversity. So that's a slide for you know, molecular virologists. So I'd like to explain that if you have at certain base, a certain point in the genome, the simultaneous presence of many bases, you have a high entropy site, and if you don't, you have a low entropy site. What I'm interested in here is like having a measure of of how much variation there is in a population, which is just, you know, an entropy averaged over all the sites, over all the bases. And it might not be the perfect measure, but it's something. And what is interesting is that this entropy, this value, I hope you can see it, goes up after the host processing. So you got from 0.008, from 0.011, more or less the same in the 2 feet. So there is actually a signature of the evolutionary processes in of a host in terms of how complex this population has become. Said that, this population was a kind of a cheat because it stayed in cell culture for a long time. I have no idea if this population, what happens to these numbers after a bottleneck, if they grow again, if they shrink, if they plateau. We are looking into it. We are not there yet.
Because what you do is inoculate a cow with what comes out of a cow's foot.
Yeah, that's what we're looking at. But if you take like these samples and then you look at the next cow, because that was actually a chain of experiment, and you have like actually ways to see how the I mean, you're pretty sure that the route was oral because there was a fence between the two cows, and so you can have like a late sample of the throat and an early sample on the next one, and you can see. I mean, it's not bad. It's kind of a very controlled experiment. We're actually running the sequencing right now.
But all particles that come out of one cow are not going to be equally infectious for the next.
No, true. So that's actually one of the biggest thing. I mean, we don't know how big the bottleneck is, and we don't know. Clearly, when you transmit the population, there will be some fit genomes, some unfit genomes, and
that's like a polio virus thing. You care about polio inside of the host because, but those are dead end.
Sorry,
so you care about, so polio is in the gut, right? But if it gets into the nervous system, that's when you care about it.
Yeah.
It's a sickness, but those variants, as far as I know, don't actually make it into the next host. That's a local evolution.
Well,
what I'm talking about is
what
could be causing sickness in one. I have no idea. But it could be what's important for sickness in one cow is a process of the evolution locally in the cow, and not so much of the process of what makes it out of one cow into the next cow. But that's your perspective.
It could be. No, it would be very interesting to look at. What is interesting is that we see that there's a lot of evolution happening in the first stage of the infection. So when basically, well this is like an artificial infection, so it's not perfect. But it's like at the beginning there's a lot of things going on, and then it's more mass replication. So you just the population explodes, and so there's a lot going on again, but for a different reason. Last thing is that one of the other things we're looking at again in this scale bridging is like to couple this data with cellular replication strategies of the virus and with mechanistic models within a cell. So I'm not going to look into that, but just one of the things I'm saying is that some of the reads we have seen encode stop codons, which are validated. I take stop codons, I'm ignoring for the moment the process of complementation, and I think that like stop codons are lethal mutations, because if you have a stop codon in your polyprotein and you have only one big open reading frame, you're not going to be fit. So if you ignore complementation, you can say that these are mutations that haven't not been selected yet, so they're just got out from a cell. So you can use them to estimate a mutation rate and compare this estimation with what is in literature by looking at the frequency of these stop codons. The only thing is that it depends also on the replication strategy in a cell, because this isn't single-stranded positive RNA viruses. So if you copy it, you make a negative strand, which is useless for the virus. So you have to copy a negative strand again to obtain a viable genome that can be encapsulated. Now, the easiest way you could do it is like you do it twice, so positive to negative to positive, and this is so-called stamping machine strategy. Another possibility would be that, you know, the positive strands will act again as template for negative strands, so you would have a geometric accumulation of positive and negative strands in a cell. It's kind of an open question. For the moment, what we have done is that we assumed the stamping machine replication, which is the one that introduced the least number of mutations, so that we have an upper bound of the mutation rate. The upper bound is in the range of 8 × 10⁻⁴, which I think we could do better because it's pretty high, and I think we can be more stringent than that using our data. I'm done with it. So
you're talking about stop codon mutants that you actually obtained from the end?
The reads have stop codons, some of them.
Okay. So
clearly the frequency of the mutations that generate a stop codon is always low.
But the success of a stop codon mutant is going to be determined by how much complementation for infection
absolutely
is happening.
Absolutely. We are ignoring that. We say like stop codon are dead.
Okay. So I guess my question is, how valid is it to ignore that? I don't know very many cases of this aside from what we see in the lab, but in dengue virus, when they were isolating variants from clinical samples in Asia, that was Eddie Holmes, I can't remember what else was on the paper, they found that those were in overabundance or even in the majority.
Yeah, I know there are. How would you measure, actually, if you have complementation or not?
Well, it's easier done in the laboratory where you have a nice signal, but I think you can do things like look at the degree of population structuring, and if you have, you can. I mean, what we've tried to do is try to figure out, based on what we see genetically in a sample. Again, you can infer to find out how much co-infection is actually happening. If the signal for co-infection that you're looking for is not complementation, but assortment or recombination, because that can't happen unless viruses are getting inside the same.
Sure, that would be like a good proxy.
But I mean, your question is a good. I don't know what.
Or if you actually knew what the mutation rate was.
Sorry.
If you actually knew the mutation rate.
We know, but I don't believe it because they've been measured quite. I mean, with all this kind of Laura Delbruck experiments, which, I don't think they're clean enough to pinpoint a number. And usually they come up with big ranges, usually a couple of orders of magnitude. So one of the aims was actually to determine the mutation rate. But maybe you should like have a chat later and then see, because I would really like if to know, like to measure how much complementation there is in the system.
I'm afraid you'd have to know a lot about mutation rate, population size in a tissue, how many cells are actually being infected would give you a sense of the MOI.
But hopefully if he could measure the mutation rate by an independent means, this measurement right here would tell him directly about complementation shortcutting.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. Well, you could like see how much, you can see, you apply like a range of mutation rates from the literature and see how much, how complementation range varies.
If you compare if you have them in culture, can you grow them in culture such that you're pretty sure that there's no complementation, right? And then compare the stop.
How do you make sure there is no complementation in cell culture?
So really low multiplicity of infection.
Okay.
Tons of cells. Right. Do the same experiment.
Then
just look at stop codons there.
Then
and compare.
Would you have enough virus to sequence them? That's could be that.
You can make viruses as you want. Can you do all that sequencing?
FMDV
grows fine. Right. With FMDV, it grows fine in the.
Yeah, it does.
So
that could be a good idea.
You can also get it in vivo if you've got early stage and late stage lesions. Mm-hmm. Assuming the late stage lesions have got higher virus ground per cell.
That's our next experiment. It's running now together with the bottleneck. Yeah, I know. We
the complementation, so we get a different rate.
That's a very good point, actually. That would probably nail it better, because having like time points of the same. I mean, because here we have we have two time points, but it's, you know, many things happen in between. If you can follow like a single lesion, like take a sample, like there are big things, so you can take a lot of samples and you can take material every 12 hours or so and then see how it evolves. Oh, I didn't mention that this thing happened fast, actually. It's 2 days between inoculum and lesions. It's a very fast growing infectious disease. Okay, I'll stop here and let me acknowledge the people who have worked on it at the University of Glasgow, at the Institute of Animal Health, where all these experiments and data are taken, and also guys in Montpellier at the Institute for National Research, because I haven't talked about what we have done with the plumpox virus, which has, we have done pretty much the same thing, looking at three leaves on a tree, which is a very, makes a very nice comparison with this, with all, in two cases, like for old and recent infections, and we do see differences in how the viruses evolve. We do see differences in complexity of the population, so I'll be happy to talk about it if someone wants to know more. And thanks for your attention.